Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Just over 24 hours ago, we brought to the news that Pascal Donoghue, Minister for Finance, was to resign from government to take up a role with the World Bank. That led to the mini cabinet reshuffle, which saw Simon Harris take over finance, Helen McEntee take foreign affairs and defence, and Hildegard Nocton move to cabinet and take over education. For now, until the end of the week, Pascal Donoghue remains a TD, but is now the incoming senior managing director and chief knowledge officer at the World Bank, and he's taken the time to be with us this morning. Pascal, I can call you. I don't have to call you minister anymore. You're very welcome to the program.
And good morning, Pat. How are you?
I'm very well. Now, congratulations, first of all, on this big move. A very significant move, I suggest, in your career. You're leaving politics at home behind you. You're also leaving home behind you.
I am indeed, with regard to my career. But with regard to my home will never change. My home is Phibsborough. And that is, will always be where I will see home being. Hmm.
But you'll have to establish a home in Washington, D.C.
Indeed, I will. And all of that is what I will move to. I begin my new job on Monday. So it is an extremely quick transition, which is frequently the case with politics and with roles like this.
It always amazes me how quickly people can walk out the door. You know, for example, it's happening in cabinet that Helen McEntee is Minister for Education. She'd close the door on education and walk into foreign affairs. Hello, good morning.
And that is also a strength of the way our system can work. And it is because of the institutions that we have in our country, because of the strength of our civil service, we can facilitate these very quick changes. But I would, though, make the point that I do believe continuity and experience has a great value. And that is one of the reasons why I'm so pleased to see colleagues like Artánaiste Simon and Helen now in the roles that they are in. But
it's the
nature of politics, okay, but things change very quickly.
But you are a money man. I mean, you know your accountancy and all the rest of it. Simon Harris does not. So what kind of a mess have you left him?
Well, I would respectfully make the point, I don't believe I've left a mess. I know your listeners, many of them are grappling with challenges in their lives and difficulties that I'm very much aware of, that we have tried to alleviate. But our country overall, in terms of our public finances, number of people at work, our public services, has made progress. I'm so happy that Simon is our new Minister for Finance. I did two budgets with him as Taoiseach and Taoiseach. He's worked in the Department of Finance before. He's chaired the Cabinet Subcommittee on the Economy. He knows as much about the job as is possible to know about it until you actually do it.
Now, why? That's the question. I mean, why did you decide to leave domestic politics? Why did you even run the last time, if this was in the back of your mind, that you'd be doing something other than politics?
So, firstly, well, the answer to the two questions is actually interrelated. This was very unexpected. It was not something that was on my agenda or something that I was expecting to happen. Certainly not in November 2024 when I stood in front of the people of Dublin Central. And then in terms, therefore, of why I am moving, firstly, it's the nature of the role itself. Once in a lifetime chance to do something like this. And when an opportunity like this comes your way, I hope people can understand the need for me to grasp it. I'm a public servant. I've always been drawn to public service and always wanted to stick at it.
And you will be a public servant in this new role, because this is an outfit run by a collective of governments.
It is indeed. And this is an opportunity to continue as a public servant in a very, very different way. It is a role that is all about how we support really the most vulnerable across the world, help countries deal with the hardest economic problems there are, and the opportunity to play a role in that across the next number of years of my life.
Just before we leave,
I want to pursue, and I want to represent Ireland doing well in. I want the people who I've represented in Dublin Central, I hope some of your listeners, to feel that there is an Irish person trying to do good work.
Before we leave domestic politics and what might happen, imagine if your political legacy was getting the monk elected in Dublin Central.
I have great faith in the wisdom of the people of Dublin Central. Enormous faith. They've already made the decision on that once.
Yeah.
I'm greatly confident in their wisdom for them to make the right decision again.
So you don't think you'll have to live to regret that eventuality?
You weigh up lots of things, Pat, when you're deciding to move on from public life. And I just have this feeling within me that each day I have done my best in the conditions that confronted me. And I have great confidence in the man who will be taking over in my office, in his office now, given all I know he can do. Great faith in Jack Chambers and my relationship with him and the relationship that he will have with Simon Harris. And then the people of Dublin Central, look, they have been so good to me, so good to me, and stood by me, including in one really, really, all elections are hard, but the 2016 general election was an acutely difficult one. And they were good enough to re-elect me. And in their wisdom, they'll make the right decision in the by-election.
Now, let's talk about the World Bank. I mean, people just hear the term, the World Bank, and
yep.
They do this, that and the other. Then they hear the IMF and they don't really. What's the difference between these two outfits? And there is a significant difference.
Very significant difference. So the World Bank is about development. The World Bank is about lending to economies and to countries that need support. And then critically, which is the work I will be involved in, helping those countries with their policies. The World Bank is about development. The IMF is a lender of last resort.
As we discovered,
and tends to be more involved in the alleviation of crises or their prevention.
So it tends to be more.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
Temporary in its activities. It will visit Greece or Ireland or whatever in difficulties, bail them out, make sure they pay it back, and then it departs.
That's one of their key roles and a general advisory role to try to prevent those difficulties happening in the first place. The World Bank is more about how we can invest and support countries who need help, who need advice, who need lending, who need financing, to help them with the great challenges of our time.
Now, there are 189 countries I read last night when I was trying to figure out what the World Bank did. All the countries, really, except Andorra, Cuba and Liechtenstein.
It's literally the bank of the world.
It is the World Bank. How is it funded?
It's funded by the contributions that governments make to us, and it is funded then by the ability of the World Bank to themselves raise money and then to engage with the private sector to encourage the private sector to support their work.
Now, when you say they raise money privately, I mean, how did they? Do they have investments, for example? Does the World Bank take money and try to get it to make money so that they can do their work in development?
So the World Bank would receive funding from governments, and on the back of the funding it receives from governments, it can do two things. It can either lend directly to those countries, or it can lend in conjunction with the private sector. And then the second thing it does, which is where I in particular will come in then, is with the money it makes available then, gives advice and focuses on policies that can then help those countries who need that support.
Now, Ireland's contribution in the latest tranche, I think, is over 140 million over a 2025 to 2028 period. The US, though, is the biggest, if you like, shareholder in the bank, is it
yeah,
not?
It is indeed. And the US has a particular relationship with the World Bank. The two institutions that you mentioned earlier on, the IMF and the World Bank, were set up in the aftermath of World War II in a place called Bretton Woods in the US. And they were part of the US's idea regarding what the economy of the world would look like after the Second World War. So because of all that, the US has a particular relationship with these two institutions. But with regard to the World Bank, President Trump, his administration, and the leading politicians within the US have continued to support the work of the World Bank. And
even though they killed off USAID, so this is separate funding than USAID.
They've continued to support the World Bank. Now they have, as other donors and funders and supporters of the World Bank do, outlined their views regarding what the World Bank should do, which all governments do. But the bottom line is, despite the many charges and debates that are underway regarding the future of our world and its economy, the second Trump administration has, in its own way, continued to fund the work of the World Bank, while, as I said a moment ago, outlining their views on how they should work.
And what sort of imperatives are they insisting upon for the World Bank?
Well, they are making the case for the World Bank playing a larger role with a focus on actually the creation and retention of jobs. And their view that the economic policies of the world need to tilt a bit more to further focus on job creation, and then particular views with regard to trade.
This is, if you take that philosophy in a general way, it's the hand up rather than the hand out.
I'd have to say, in fairness again to what has happened, they are supporting the World Bank and its functions that involve
literally bailing
a handout
people out,
for want of a better phrase. But the World Bank doesn't really do that, because what the World Bank aims to do, and here perhaps there's a different distinction, you hear a lot of us sometimes talk about safety nets. Well, nets can catch you when you fall, but they can help you bounce back as well. And what the World Bank tries to do is really do the latter. Put in place the policies that can help countries grow quicker, and grow quicker in a way that helps them with their resilience. And it's in that resilience point we then come into many challenges with regard to climate, the nature of societies, which the World Bank tries to play a positive role in.
Had you interactions with the World Bank before?
I'm in my role as Minister for Finance. I was a governor of the World Bank. And through that work, I had an awful lot of exposure to their work.
Now, the bank's own independent evaluation says the bank has too many priorities and that its accountability is weak as a result. That's the, if you like, internal assessment. What say you?
That it is really important that every organisation have its own rigour and way of scrutinising their ability to perform. I always look too at the, for example, the latest annual report of the World Bank. I believe last year they lent out and invested, either directly or indirectly, $117 billion in the future of the world. And what is so inspirational to me is where that work and money goes. So this is an organisation that's helping parts of the world that don't have access to electricity get it. This is an organisation that is helping the hundreds of millions of young women and men in different parts of our world that at the moment don't have a prospect of a job to get one. It's the organisation that is helping young girls have access to those things that we believe they should have access to by right.
Now, a bank expects to get its money back.
And the World Bank does. And the World Bank does because it plays an ongoing role in these issues. And because that role is ongoing, of course, all the incentives are there for those who are working with them to keep on working with them.
Now, how are decisions made? I mean, how are projects funded? How are countries funded? If you decide that a country is a basket case, that it really needs that economic injection, who makes that decision?
So the very work of the World Bank is to try to prevent any country ever becoming, as you've just described, a basket case. It's all about trying to avoid that happening. And to answer your question in terms of how the decisions are made, the majority of the decisions, particularly in terms of policy advice, are made by the staff of the World Bank, which I will be one of on Monday, in relation to some of the very bigger decisions on policy, and also then in relation to funding. There will be a group of those decisions that the staff and will then take to the board of the World Bank and say to the board of the World Bank, look, this is a really significant decision. We need your consent to it. And to bring it back to the question you just asked me a few moments ago, the people on the board of the World Bank are then representatives of the governments that fund the World Bank.
And so the United States would always be sitting around that table as
yes, they would.
19% shareholding, they reckon the United States has.
That is correct, Pat.
Okay, so who would be there? Scott Bessent or...?
His representatives are there.
Okay.
So each country has... Each country is a member of what is called a constituency, something I'm very familiar with. A constituency, in my case, is still Dublin Central. A constituency within the World Bank is a group of countries. Each group of countries has an executive director.
Because you can't have 189 people sitting around a table.
And some constituencies, for example, the role of America, the role of China, the role of the very big economies is pretty distinct and pure and singular. Because they have such a big contribution to the World Bank. But that feeds up to the work that the board does. And then staff of the World Bank then in some key areas bring recommendations to the board.
Now, is there a power of veto? You know, the criticism of the United Nations that the Security Council, any one member can veto, and it doesn't happen, no matter how worthy the objective might be in the UN. Is there a veto in the World Bank?
So the analogy I would draw is with the government of Ireland. So there tends to be at times a perception that what happens in cabinet is the potential for the cabinet to veto ideas or to vote down ideas and proposals and policies happening. That rarely happens. What instead happens is by the time it gets to the cabinet and to the government of Ireland, the key decisions with regard to it have been proposed. And there is an alignment in relation to the journey of travel. So that by the time it gets to the government for a decision to be made, the substantive direction is clear. That would be the same within the World Bank. It would be my role working with my colleagues to have these matters resolved before it gets to the very highest level of the World Bank for a decision.
Now, you will be attending, not this time, but maybe next time, COP as the representative of the World Bank. You'll be going to the G7?
Yes.
The G20?
Yes.
All of those kind of meetings?
Yes.
You'll be Mr. World Bank?
Well, the president of the World Bank is Ajay Banga. He's the leader of the World Bank. And I will be supporting him in his duties at those meetings.
Okay, but he is appointed by the United States because that's in their remit.
That is correct.
To appoint the president of,
yes,
of the World Bank. Now, what about China? Because the World Bank actually still gives money to China every year. Yet China has said, we have worked our way out of poverty. We are not a poor country anymore. Why keep giving them money?
Well, there are many, many parts of China that amidst the extraordinary historic decision that they have made, transition that they have made, that still do need support and still do receive the advice and guidance and funding of the World Bank. I've no doubt, you know, as China continues with its transformative journey, the nature of the relationship that they have with the World Bank will change in the future, as is the case with other parts of the world. But China obviously has a very, very, very important relationship with the World Bank, given their share now of the global economy.
How much has your work in Europe helped you to prepare for this job?
I think it's a number of different ingredients in my public life so far have got me to this point. And Pat, you know, before we went on air, I commented on that you've interviewed me now throughout my entire public life, haven't you?
I have indeed.
In different studios, yeah, on different issues, in different ways. And if somebody remarked that I'd been a bit of a constant in Fine Gael over the number, yeah, over recent years and during that time, a constant has me been interviewed by you, and I'm grateful for that. That leads then maybe to the kind of talking then about what has got me to this point. I think there are a few ingredients. Undoubtedly, my work at a European level and even at an international level within the Eurogroup, and then the work that I've done with regard to international policy and tax policy got me in front of many, many, many different audiences. And that did play a role. But I think at the heart of it is the experiences that I developed in Dublin Central and then the work and knowledge and wisdom that others have given me when I have worked in the government of Ireland. And that's at the heart of it.
But at the same time, you've had to deal with finance ministers from very powerful countries. Before Brexit, you'd be dealing with the British Chancellor of the Exchequer. You'd be dealing with the finance ministers in Germany and Italy and France. So therefore, you know you can mix it with the big boys, which is helpful, I suspect, in going into this new job.
It is indeed a part of what I have done on behalf of our country and Europe over the last number of years. But actually, I would, again, sincerely relate it back to my life as a TD here in Dublin, in Dublin Central. And again, please just let me offer my most sincere thanks to the opportunity to represent Dublin Central in the Dáil over a number of terms now, and the communities of Dublin Central for supporting me in my work and voting for me.
What you're really saying is if you can make it in Dublin's North Inner City, you can make it anywhere.
What I'm actually saying is that if you sit in a constituency office in Phibsborough, which I did for many years, and you've great people coming into you, talking to you about the challenges within their lives and what is going on and asking you for your help, that really gives you a foundation upon which you build everything else. And to bring that to life, I remember one time being in a meeting in Brussels and my mobile phone was going. And it was a constituent who I had been working with. And I remarked to a fellow finance minister that I needed to take this call and get back to this person. And not all finance ministers have constituencies. In some countries, if you become a finance minister or a member of government, you don't have a constituency anymore. You're just a member of government. And I remember remarking to my colleague that it's actually the foundation of all the experiences you pick up being a constituency TD are the heart then of how it has helped me to do other work. And I have lived in and represented the best part of the best city in the world. And I hope that as they see me do what I'm about to do, they will realise that the opportunities they've afforded me translate into what I'm about to do.
Final question. Are you in any way apprehensive?
I am always motivated by huge challenge. Always motivated. Actually, I have loved my time in Irish politics. I've cherished it. And I've had some tough days and demanding days that are insignificant in comparison to the demands that many experienced and still experience in their daily lives. And I always want to be humble in the face of that. But truly what has motivated me every day is trying to make a difference. And then particularly when you're dealing with a great challenge, and we have had many and have many now. So in truth, I'm now facing a whole new world. A very, very, very big organisation dealing with the greatest challenges in our world and the greatest opportunities. And I would be hopping on a plane, going over to begin a new part of my life doing that. So, of course, I look on that with a sense of awe and a real sense of how lucky I am. And that, in turn, is a great sense of motivation. Like when I walk in to my office, when I walk into the building in which I'll be doing my work, when I'm going to different parts of the world, I'll be meeting people who are confronting challenges that are indeed greater than we are used to in Ireland. And that is the opportunity to help with that is, look, it's just such a privilege, and I'm looking forward to making a difference.
Well, Pascal Donoghue, we wish you the very best in Washington, D.C., and as the Americans might say to you, thank you for your service.
Well, Pat, thank you so much, and thank you very much.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.